Joining us on the Pollen and Allergies Pod today is Narelle Williamson from the National Asthma Council of Australia. Welcome along, Narelle. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Your title is Senior Clinical Consultant, and you've got a Bachelor of Nursing. Is that right?
That's right. Yes, I did my bachelor. I won't say exactly how many years ago. So I've worked in tertiary in hospitals in a variety of different roles and then started presenting for the National Asthma Council after I got my qualification as a respiratory educator. So I've been presenting for our education program for about 12 years, and now I manage the education program. And my formal title, Sam, is Senior Clinical Consultant. So yeah, I've got the nursing hat on. I've consulted with patients in primary care, as well as presenting. And I also work in pediatric palliative care, would you believe? So two very different jobs.
You must be a good soul, Narelle.
Yeah, it's a tough one, but it's very rewarding.
How does one become a respiratory educator, Narelle?
Well, there's unfortunately, Sam, not a lot of university courses nowadays for becoming a respiratory educator, but I actually did my course years ago at the Alfred at the Lung Health Promotion Unit, and it was a three-day course, which they have other courses on spirometry and smoking cessation, a whole library of courses there, which they still run. And that's, I think, as far as I know from recent times, the only place where you can become a respiratory educator or get your qualification as a respiratory educator. And anything, it's experience really that really best leads you into the role of, yeah, you definitely have to be doing it in training. You can't just really go and do the qualification. It's really just the patient interaction and consultations and with other primary care health professionals. Yeah, that give you the experience.
You must get to learn a lot on the job, listening to parents and kids tell you their stories. It must be very informative in terms of how you educate other people.
Yeah, definitely. And every child with asthma or every adolescent with asthma or every adult, every story is different, which keeps the job interesting because you're not quite sure when a patient walks through the door what their history is, what their family history is, what their symptoms are. And although we say that there's four common symptoms with asthma, you don't necessarily have to have all those four symptoms to have asthma. And of course, it's not diagnosed under the age of one. So a lot of babies are in hospital with such things as bronchiolitis. You know, and it's not formally called asthma, but then it develops into asthma and they may have eczema as babies as well. So yeah, there's a lot of variety, even though people do tend to think it's pretty straightforward.
You've been kind enough to respond to some of our listener questions, so why don't we get straight into it? Now, the first question we have is around, what are the links between allergies and asthma exacerbations?
Yeah, allergy plays a really important role in asthma. It's one of the major factors associated with the cause and the persistence of asthma. Asthma is a chronic lung disease. It can be controlled. Unfortunately, it can't be cured. But the major characteristic of asthma is chronic inflammation in the lining of the small airways of the lungs. So allergy itself can produce this inflammation in the airways. So for someone who is sensitive to one or more allergens, exposure to that allergen can trigger an asthma flare-up or an exacerbation. So the airway lining becomes inflamed, the muscles in the airway tighten, there's excess mucus production, and then the airways narrow and cause breathing difficulties such as those symptoms, the four symptoms of shortness of breath, cough, wheeze, chest tightness. Some people might find they wake up in the middle of the night with cough or wheeze. So allergy is very common in Australia. Around 40% of people are allergic to something. And asthma is also common, affecting around 11% of people, but 80% of people with asthma have positive allergy test results, either on skin prick testing or in blood tests. And globally, the prevalence of allergy is continuing to increase, particularly in developed countries such as Australia. And you know, Sam, down here in Victoria, we've got a high rate of allergies down here, unfortunately.
The inflammation you talk about here, Narelle, is that the same as kids who have viral-induced wheezing, where it's the virus that's causing their airways to get inflamed?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, with kids in particular, their trigger is viral-induced viruses, which brings on that viral-induced wheeze or you know, from 2 years of age, they might be diagnosed with asthma, but it's about that common allergic trigger, or some people might be allergic to house dust mite, mold, pollens, et cetera, whereas for children, the most common trigger for them for asthma or for induced wheeze is, as the name suggests, viruses. So winter's a really hard time for children with respiratory illness. A lot of presentations to the Royal Children's Hospital and Monash Children's. Yeah, so it can be a nasty time for the little ones.
What percentage of kids grow out of viral-induced wheezing, and what percentage of them will go on to have a more traditional form of asthma?
I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, Sam, but again, it depends on family history. If mum or dad, that first line of family history, grandparents, mum, dad, siblings, if there's any history there of asthma, hay fever, eczema, there's more likely a chance that the child will continue to have asthma throughout childhood, adolescence, and potentially into adulthood. It really just depends on that history, and that's why it's so important for people to go and see their GP or their respiratory specialist to really delve deep into what the triggers are, what the history is. But certainly some children can grow out of it, but others not so much. But figures would be nice to know. I might look that up, Sam.
Are there treatments out there that can desensitize you to allergies or even cure you of your allergies?
Well, immunotherapy is the process by which we retrain, for want of a better word, the immune system to not react to an allergen, so also known as desensitization, as you said, can be a preferred option for a lot of patients rather than them having to have continual use of nasal sprays or other medications. It involves regular administration of allergen extracts, and it can be given sublingually under the tongue or subcutaneously, a little needle just under the skin. So these allergens are delivered to promote clinical tolerance, and treatment is usually for 3 to 4 years to produce ongoing benefit. So it's quite a commitment from patients, but it is the only treatment that can alter the allergic response. So I've seen a lot of patients in my respiratory clinics who have been able to go through the process of immunotherapy and come out the other end, yeah, being cured of their allergic rhinitis. So it can work. Again, I'm not sure of figures, Sam, but it definitely can work. As I said, it's the only treatment that can alter the allergic response of the body.
So it's a bit like training for a big fight. Your body trains you for the fight when it's coming, and then when it's boxing time, you've done the training, your body knows how to fight it properly, and you're a chance of not getting knocked out. Is that a good analogy?
Yeah. And of course, we only give, at the start of a treatment regime, we only give very, very minute amounts of this allergen because we're actually, you know, either injecting or giving an allergen to someone that they're allergic to under their tongue. So, of course, we need to start in very minute amounts and gradually increase it over that time period. So some people can get reaction initially, of course. So that's why it takes so long, because we don't want to give huge doses to begin with, of course.
In the US, immunotherapy is quite common amongst children who have food allergies. Are we seeing more immunotherapy being delivered here in Australia?
There's definitely immunotherapy for food allergies. And from what I've heard and read, it's very successful in the US, and no doubt we'll be following along the patterns of US medicine. But a lot of people a lot of health professionals would conduct skin prick testing as that, I guess, the gold standard of detecting allergies. But now it's more blood tests, IgE blood tests, also called the RAST test. And that blood test can actually test for up to 100 different allergens. So it's really useful rather than having to put a poor child or a baby through a skin prick test and having to prick their skin.
I've seen those skin prick tests. They look pretty brutal.
Yeah, they are pretty. I used to very much dislike performing those on children. You had to pretty much swaddle them up and get mum or dad to hold the child down. And much easier on adults when we use the forearm in adults. But I think now a lot of people would prefer the one prick in the skin for the blood test, and you can test for many, many different foods, as well as all the pollens, the molds, etc. Animals, animal dander. You can test up to 100 different potential allergens, or you can individualize the animal. So it could be specifically cats you're wanting to test for, or dogs or horses, or yucky little things like cockroaches and all those bits and pieces, and lots of different individual foods as well. A great test, very useful.
And how does one go about getting the blood test? Do you visit your family GP? Is that the first point of call?
Yeah, exactly. Just go to your regular GP and they will run a pathology slip. They might also refer you to an allergist. And then going forward, if someone was to decide to go through the immunotherapy regime, then you would definitely need referral to an allergist, because they are the one that orders the allergen extracts in the little bottles. But again, immunotherapy is usually then performed just at your GP clinic from lovely practice nurses who are the ones that have to, yeah, give the needle.
The National Asthma Council has a program called Sensitive Choice, where folks can go and find all sorts of products and services that can help them reduce their exposure to those type of allergens. Tell us a little bit more about the Sensitive Choice program.
Well, the NAC created the Sensitive Choice program back in 2006. And as you said, Sam, it helps people identify products and services that are asthma and allergy friendly through our trusted blue butterfly. So the butterfly is on all our products and services that have been reviewed and approved by an independent expert panel, and they determine their potential benefit to people with asthma and allergies. So you can find the reassuring blue butterfly on hundreds of products, including bedding, building products, flooring, cleaning agents, carpets, and of course through COVID, air purifiers, vacuum cleaners, and a lot more. So only products and services that have been through this review process will hopefully provide a potential benefit to someone with asthma and allergies that carry that blue butterfly logo. So we've got lots of tips and tricks on how you can reduce triggers around your home. And anyone listening can visit the Sensitive Choice website or the National Asthma Council website for lots of those tips and tricks.
And the Sensitive Choice website, that's sensitivechoice.com. Is that right?
That's correct.
Alrighty, let's move on to the next question. Someone asks, what are the links between asthma and eczema?
Many people, as I said at the top, around 40% of people are allergic to something. So we say that many people are atopic. So atopic, that means the genetic tendency to develop allergic conditions. So they have an increased risk of developing conditions such as hay fever, otherwise known as allergic rhinitis, eczema, and they're very closely linked. Then you have things like hives and anaphylaxis. They're more so related to food allergies, whereas the hay fever and eczema more so related to our environmental factors, if you know, the pollens, the molds, animals, etc. And yeah, as Katie would have talked about, a very close relationship. And unfortunately, anyone who has hay fever or eczema will more than likely have a big chance of having asthma as well. Right, it's the body responding to this allergen trigger. It's the immune system reacting to common substances. So again, pollen, house dust, mite, molds, animal dander. And it just depends how that comes out in a body, you know, whether it's in breathing or in your skin.
Eczema is often quite localized. Is the eczema caused still by allergens coming in through the nose, or is it purely through skin coming into contact with the allergen?
It can be both, Sam. It can be both. In babies, it will generally more so be through touch. So it's something on the skin, but it can be through the respiratory system as well. It can also obviously be through the gastrointestinal system as well. So some children will get, eczema from food allergies. So that's obviously through, you know, them swallowing foods going into their gut. So it's all about getting into the bloodstream and then producing that response that we hopefully a lot of other people don't have. But yes, it's all about our immune system. Can be through touch, can be through inhalation, and can be through ingestion into the GI tract.
And are babies more likely to get it via skin contact because they have more sensitive skin?
Yeah, that can be true, definitely. But again, older children and adolescents, you know, they may just touch something or be exposed to something that's abnormal for them, or something that they've never touched. It can be things as something as simple as a different washing detergent or a washing powder. It can be changed in the usual. A lot of research is still being done, Sam, but Yeah, I think with babies, because their immune system obviously is not as developed as older children, adolescents and adults, they do get, they're more susceptible, I guess is the way to put it.
Recall reading somewhere that it's the double dip that can cause eczema to be quite stubborn and difficult to get rid of. You put the cream on an affected spot and then put that finger straight back into the tub and then reapply it on the skin. Is that correct?
Definitely a risk for sure.
Righto, let's move on to the next question. Is it possible to have hay fever year round?
It is possible to have year round hay fever, yes. So it depends on whether someone has perennial symptoms or triggers that will cause perennial symptoms. So again, the house dust mites, the molds, the animal dander, that will lead someone to have year round symptoms. Whereas seasonal, as the name suggests, usually spring, summer, or early summer, that is where symptoms are predominantly due to pollens from our seasonal grasses and our trees and our weeds. So unfortunately for those people who do have year-round hay fever, it's awful for them. But yeah, they do tend to suffer the runny nose, the rubbing of the eyes, the itchy nose, the sneezing, the locked nose, snoring at night, all of those symptoms year-round, which is not good for their partners either.
Do you recommend keeping a diary of your symptoms that you can share with your doctor or your allergist to help them diagnose exactly what it is that's causing your symptoms?
That's a great tip, Sam. If anyone listening thinks they may have an allergy, keep a symptom diary to identify their triggers, record the times and situations when their symptoms are worse, and then see your doctor for advice. Usually for a fortnight or so is a good idea to keep a diary and try and keep a record of, is it early in the evening that their nose runs more or first thing in the morning? Those sorts of bits and pieces. Everyone is different, but yeah, identifying the allergens and then going to your health professional will help to know, obviously, then manage and reduce exposure to allergen triggers.
And by diary, you don't mean a physical diary. I'm assuming you can use the notes on your iPhone or similar?
Phones are very handy for that, Sam. Very handy. Any notepad or plain A4 piece of paper, whatever they can easily access and write on is perfectly fine. But yeah, the notes section does come in handy.
The next question pertains to the higher incidence of asthma and allergies in the western suburbs. Doesn't say whether it's Sydney or Melbourne. What light can you shed on that?
Yeah, definitely. And I've just finished a project with the Victorian government and a few organisations that we always work closely with. And inner west Melbourne is definitely a hotspot for air pollution and respiratory illnesses. And so Hobson's Bay, Maribyrnong, those LGAs, because we've got so many different types of transport going through, children particularly are affected because their lungs are still developing. And there are a lot of presentations to emergency departments, particularly obviously the Royal Children's Hospital being in Parkville, easy access for families in that area. But the air pollution there is definitely a problem. And then we've also got the issue of thunderstorm asthma, which is a big problem for the inner west and Melbourne in general. I can't speak too much for Sydney, Sam, but I've never lived in Sydney, but I would assume that there would be similar areas.
Here's my $1 billion idea. You ready for it? I don't know how you make $1 billion out of it, to be honest, but it is surprising to me that sites like realestate.com, you can't overlay an air quality filter that would allow you to perhaps identify streets or suburbs that you don't want to buy a house in or rent a house in if you do suffer from respiratory disease.
Yeah, that'd be good to know, wouldn't it?
Any boffins listening out there who can solve that problem for us, get in touch. Actually, who should do it? Ed, who's the founder of Air Health and Melbourne Pollen. He's a smart man. He can do it for sure.
He is. He could do it, definitely. But it was really interesting doing this project with the Victorian government. Really opened our eyes at the National Asthma Council and Asthma Australia and the Royal Children's Hospital as to just how many presentations there are from people living in those LGAs in West Melbourne.
And that study, was it doing actual readings of air pollution or just looking at presentations to doctors and hospitals to make an inference that perhaps it was being driven by air pollution?
No, it was studies from the environmental team at the department, and then that was passed on all the organisations that were involved in the project. There were actually five smaller projects within the umbrella of improving childhood asthma management in West Melbourne. So the government did all the hard work with the research on the pollution and industrial issues and pass it on for us to try to find solutions, or if not solutions, better ways to manage asthma in children, but also in adults. It will go on further to lead into further trials with adults, I believe, and better management.
And will the outcome of that research be published anywhere, Narelle? Where can people read about it, people who may be interested or maybe living in those western suburbs of Sydney or Melbourne?
Yeah, you can actually find it on the National Asthma Council website. If you just type in, I think it's under project.
We'll pop a link into the show notes so folks can find it easily.
Yeah, we can put a link in. That would be good. And it's also on the government website as well.
You mentioned thunderstorm asthma earlier. Folks living in the western suburbs of Melbourne more likely to be affected by thunderstorm asthma activity?
Well, the western suburbs are closer to grasslands and pasturelands. It's closer to the western district and north of Victoria, where the weather often comes from the west, obviously. So the inner west is often the first to be hit. And people may remember, I'm sure they remember, the 2016 thunderstorm asthma event that hit us in Melbourne here in late November. And it was the inner west that, again, was the first to be hit. But all of our public hospital emergency departments, Ambulance Victoria, pharmacists, general practices were all inundated the 24 to 36 hours after that thunderstorm event. People probably listening may get worried that it's every thunderstorm too, Sam, and it's not. It's a particular type of thunderstorm throughout spring and early summer. But it does. It's that the wind gust that precedes a thunderstorm. Thunderstorm asthma can be triggered by exposure to those high concentration of pollen fragments. The pollen grains get swept up into the clouds as the storm matures. Whether or not the two Eds would know more precisely than me, but I think we're still unsure whether it is actually the moisture in the cloud that fragments those whole pollen grains or whether it's the wind gusts. But in any case, they're fragmented into much smaller particles, as you have said that Katie went through. Pollen fragments are usually around 20 to 30 or sometimes 40 microns in size. They're easily filtered in our nose, but these particular thunderstorms in spring and early summer can break those pollen grains into less than 5 microns, so obviously much, much, much smaller, too small to be filtered in our nose, and therefore people inhale them. And we certainly don't want a repeat of the 2016 Melbourne thunderstorm asthma event. So hopefully through education and people preparing, seeing their GP come springtime, we can prevent something like that happening again, where of course tragically 10 people passed away. So we'd like for that not to be repeated.
The Bureau of Meteorology and the Victorian Department of Health and Human Services, DHHS, were the first in Australia to fund the thunderstorm asthma warning system. And for those people who don't know, Melbourne Pollen provides the pollen counts and pollen forecasts that are key inputs into that modelling. When there's a likelihood of a thunderstorm asthma event, it's widely distributed through the mass media, but people can, of course, use the Melbourne Pollen or the Sydney and Perth Pollen apps as a first-line warning system as well.
Yes, and we promote that heavily in our education from the NAC, you'll be happy to know, Sam, and even through the ICAM project that I was talking about. We promoted Melbourne Pollen, obviously being in Melbourne, but it's fantastic because it can obviously tell us, because it monitors levels of those airborne grass pollens across Victoria and can provide us with accurate, relevant, localised information. So it's fantastic. And being able to tell us from the 1st of October through to the 31st of December about epidemic thunderstorm asthma risk is just another bonus. So it's very useful. We run a webinar through the National Asthma Council right throughout this period of spring. The Melbourne Pollen app is very strongly promoted.
If you haven't downloaded the Melbourne Pollen app or Allergy Pal or Sydney Canberra Perth Pollen, make sure you do, because Narelle will be coming back on to do a webinar, I think in November. Is that right, Narelle?
Yeah, that's right. At the end of November, that'll be good.
The next question applies to home remedies. They're asking, are we aware of any home remedies that you could make yourself that don't require you to purchase something from the pharmacy or via a prescription from your doctor?
I've not actually heard of any home remedies. My main concern is that people do tend to just go into the pharmacies, because a lot of medications are available over the counter. The antihistamine tablets, a few of the intranasal corticosteroid sprays are available over the counter as well. So I would have thought that a lot more people would be going in, not actually to see their GP, but straight into the pharmacy to just grab something off the shelf. And that's where we rely on our pharmacists to question patient and say, have you got these symptoms? Have you seen your GP? And ask them to delve a bit deeper rather than just handing something over. But as for home remedies, yeah, as I say, I've not heard of any in particular, Sam, but as far as the home's concerned and going back to sensitive choice, I guess it's tips and tricks such as hot washing your linen. A lot of people don't like washing in hot water, but it's only, you know, high temperatures that will kill dust mite from your bed linen. Children having 20 stuffed toys on their bed that they want to sleep with. Get your child to just choose one soft toy per night to sleep with. Vacuuming with a really good, I won't mention manufacturers.
Products with the teal butterfly, of course, girl.
Yeah, that's right. Hard flooring, you know, keeping pets out of rooms. We don't expect anyone to, you know, get rid of their pet from their family or adopt their pets out, but just things like that. But as far as actually taking something, I can't really answer that question, Sam. I'm not too sure.
That was the last question for today, but we are coming into peak pollen season, being October. Is there anything further you would like to add, Narelle, before you grace us with your presence again in November for your webinar?
I guess I would just advise anyone listening to stay up to date with pollen forecasts, thunderstorm asthma forecasts, particularly if they live in or are travelling with work, perhaps to a region with seasonal high grass pollen levels. And just the tips of if you are susceptible, if you suffer from allergic rhinitis, or if you have asthma, you are susceptible to thunderstorm asthma. So avoid being outdoors just before and during thunderstorms that are going to be occurring in summer and spring, especially during those wind gusts, as I said, that precede the rain front. But make sure that they see their GP, get an allergic rhinitis action plan, or if they suffer from asthma, they should definitely have a written asthma action plan. Make sure they are taking their regular preventer medications. So for allergic rhinitis, that would be the nasal sprays. If it's asthma, it would be preventer medications that they inhale. So they contain corticosteroids. They're the only medication that is going to deal with that inflammation inside the lungs or inside our nasal passages. And they really should be commenced 2 weeks before pollen season and continued right throughout the pollen season. And I think that's where a lot of people make the mistakes that they take it for a couple of days and think that will do, but really imperative that they stick to their dosing regime and continue it right throughout this season.
I guess the old adage, don't die wondering, really does quite literally apply here. And that is, if you're not sure whether or not you do have allergies or asthma or any of these allergic conditions, please do go and see your doctor, and whether it's get a blood test to check that what you might be allergic to, or just to talk to your doctor about getting your symptoms under control. That's probably our most pertinent point of advice today.
Yeah, I think if someone hasn't managed to identify, and it is hard, a lot of people don't just have one allergen. That's the problem. A lot of people will have a dust mite allergen and a ryegrass allergen. If you're adverse to needles, the skin prick testing probably isn't going to be your best friend either. So I would suggest the blood test. It's just one small prick in the skin. Very easy. There's so many different allergens that can be tested in the blood test as opposed to the skin prick testing. So it's the easiest way to identify exactly what those triggers are and hopefully enable people to manage allergies better.
The National Asthma Council has lots of fabulous resources, so just remind listeners of your web address again, Narelle.
It's nationalasthma.org.au.
And if folks wanted to reach out to you personally and perhaps organise some educational training, what's the best way for people to find you?
Yes, they can go onto the National Asthma Council website, look under the tab at the top called Education. And you will see all our different formats of education, the face-to-face workshops and the webinars. Also our how-to video library where we explain every single asthma medication and allergic rhinitis medication, how to take those. And in there is the link to myself or to Sal. And we'd be more than happy to present any type of education for anyone who is interested.
That was terrific. Thanks, Narelle. Super informative. If people have any questions for Narelle, feel free to send them in to us, and perhaps we can twist your arm and get you back on for another Ask Me Anything episode.
Thanks, Seth.
We look forward to having you back on again soon for your webinar, and get out there and enjoy some of this lovely spring weather.
You too, Sam. Thanks for having me.